From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Mohammed, 31, has arrived here from Cham Chamal. He brought home a little contraption he found while he was out fishing. He thought it might come in handy somehow. He was lucky. When the bomb exploded, it only wounded his face, chest and hands.
Today, we'll speak with a doctor who does emergency work around the world. He's just returned from Afghanistan, before that Iraq, before that Sierra Leone. We'll talk about it all. One candidate drops out at the last minute. Another surges from third place to first. Still another is closing quickly on the outside. The Iowa caucus is in full swing. We'll speak with John Nichols of The Nation. Public corruption. We'll look at the 10 most corrupt states in the United States. And we'll talk with a representative of Reporters Without Borders.
The situation of journalists covering war zones is becoming very grave.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As 30,000 Shiite Iraqis took to the streets of Basra Thursday demanding direct elections, the crowds chanted, "No, no, USA, yes, yes, for elections, and no to America, we're coming to you, Sistani." Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani is the powerful Shiite cleric who has opposed the U.S. plans to form an indirectly elected interim government. Sistani has called for a truly democratic election, where he wants all of the Iraqi people to be able to vote on the future of the Iraqi government. A close representative of Sistani told Abu Dhabi TV that if the U.S. rejects the call for open elections, Sistani would issue a fatwa that would greatly deprive the U.S.-led governing council of legitimacy in the eyes of Shiite Iraqis. The BBC is reporting that the second most powerful Shiite cleric, Hojat al-Islam Ali Abdul Hakim al-Safi, has written a letter to the U.S. and British questioning whether the proposed transition plan has more to do with U.S. elections than Iraqi interests. Meanwhile, the U.S. head of the occupation, Paul Bremer, rushed back to Washington to discuss how to save the U.S. plan to hand over power to an interim Iraqi government by July 1st. Bremer is expected to meet with President Bush today and with U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan on Monday. The Washington Post reports the White House is now reaching out to the United Nations with hopes that the world body can play a role in the transfer of power. And as a sign, the U.S. is reaching out to other nations on the U.N. Security Council. Administration officials said Thursday the U.S. may reverse itself and allow France, Germany, and Russia to bid on Iraqi reconstruction contracts. In other news from Iraq, the Associated Press is reporting that three foreign contractors with Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root died in Iraq earlier this week when their convoy came under attack. New poll figures coming out of Iowa show that former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, Senators John Kerry and John Edwards, and Congressmember Richard Gephardt are in a virtually four-way dead heat 3 days before the state's caucus. We'll have more on that in just a minute. The Washington Post is reporting the U.S. aerospace and energy industries stand to reap billions of dollars in contracts if the country proceeds with President Bush's new space plans. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Halliburton are among the companies that would profit most. The Post notes that in 2000, a Halliburton scientific advisor wrote an article for the Oil and Gas Journal about the importance of exploring Mars. Halliburton is hoping to develop new drilling techniques on Mars that could then be used to improve oil drilling on Earth. The Israeli government is warning Hamas it will soon resume assassination attempts on the group's top leaders, including the spiritual leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Despite international pressure, the U.S. has decided not to release three teenagers who've been detained at Guantanamo Bay for over a year. Doctors estimate the boys are between 13 and 15 years old. They're among 660 prisoners who've been held at the military base. None of the men face charges or have been given an opportunity to appeal their detention. Only one of the 660 has had any contact with family members. Some have now been held for 2 years. Former Nixon White House counsel John Dean is preparing to publish a new book in April entitled Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. According to the Hartford Courant, the book, quote, argues that the White House's distortions on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction may involve impeachable offenses. In Afghanistan, Agence France-Presse is reporting the government has reversed itself and is once again banning the broadcast of women singers on state TV. On Monday, the state network made history when it broadcast images of the popular artist Salma singing. Such images hadn't been broadcast in Afghanistan since 1992. But now the TV network has reinstated a ban after the Supreme Court complained about the broadcast. The head of the network said, quote, current circumstances are not suitable to air women singing. Mexico is asking the International Court of Justice in The Hague to order the retrial of 52 Mexican citizens who are on death row in the United States. Mexico charges the United States violated a treaty guaranteeing that foreigners arrested in the U.S. have access to a representative of their government. In Iran, officials have raised the official death toll to last month's earthquake to 41,000 people. CBS is refusing to sell ad time during the Super Bowl to two organizations, Move On and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, because CBS claims it doesn't accept advocacy advertising. Move On recently held a contest called Bush in 30 Seconds that asked for filmmakers to make a 30-second anti-Bush ad. More than 1,100 videos were submitted. Move On planned to show the winning ad during the Super Bowl. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals were planning to broadcast an ad that charged eating meat can cause impotence. In Mexico, riot police clashed with local people in the indigenous town of Tlalnepantla in Morelos, Mexico. The people there, south of Mexico City, declared themselves autonomous and seized the town hall after refusing to recognize the mayor since November. Armed riot police stormed the town earlier this week, leaving at least two people dead. Dozens are missing and wounded. Yesterday, we talked with Greg Berger, who is a documentary filmmaker living in the state of Morales.
A armed incursion by the state police of about 1,500 riot police stormed the town. There were snipers placed on buildings. A rain of bullets fell on the people who were holding the city hall as an autonomous municipality. And at least two people were killed. Many people were beaten. I personally spoke with several old women who were beaten in the face and body by the riot police. Many of the people from the town ran into the hills and are currently being chased with helicopters and police dogs through the woods. And the entire town is basically in a state of siege. We are asking that people contact the governor of the state of Morelos, Sergio Estrada Cajigal, to let him know that the international eyes are watching what's happening, and that this cannot go by with impunity. And his email address is gobernador, like governor in Spanish. That's GOBERNADOR at Morelos, MORELOS dot GOB dot MX. Please email the governor of the state of Morelos and tell him that you demand an immediate withdrawal of the police from the town of Tlalnepantla. And also call your Mexican consulate in your region if you possibly can.
Greg Berger, documentary filmmaker living in the state of Morelos in Mexico.
Voting representation, we want voting representation, we want voting representation, we want voting representation,
we want voting representation,
we want the voting representation,
we want the
voting representation,
we want the
voting representation,
we want the voting representation.
voting representation.
We want the district representation.
We want the voting representation.
We want the district representation.
We want the voting representation.
We want the district representation.
We want the voting representation.
We want the
district
representation.
We want the voting representation.
We want the
district
representation.
We want the
voting representation.
We want the
district representation.
We want the
district
representation.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Well, Juan, we are chilling here in New York.
4 degrees, Amy, 4 degrees.
Yesterday in Central Park last night, 1 degree, the first time in about a century.
Yes.
And I cannot believe that here we are in the midst of this, and I am headed to Vermont today to meet listeners and viewers in Waitsfield at the Mountaintop Film Festival in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King. That's at 6:30 tonight at the Eclipse Theater. And they, I think their reports are something like 35 degrees below zero. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing.
Well, you know, Amy, one of the things I've been writing about quite a bit in the last week in the New York Daily News is this. In 2 weeks, there will be the closing of the last sugar refinery in the borough of Brooklyn, or in New York City, actually. The old Domino Sugar plant, which is actually dates back 150 years to H.L. Havemeyer and the original Sugar Trust, when the Brooklyn waterfront was the center of sugar production in the United States. It's about to be closed in 2 weeks. 250 people will be tossed out of work. And the people who are doing it are the new sugar barons of America. Not H.O. Havemeyer, but now the Von Jewell brothers, who you're very familiar with, Alfie and Pepe Von Jewell, Cuban-American immigrants who are bankrollers of both the Democratic and the Republican Party and who receive about $65 million a year in price subsidies from the United States government. And they're not losing any money, but I think they've decided that given how Williamsburg, the borough in the section of Brooklyn, is now a hot real estate property, they have 11 acres in that factory right on the waterfront. And the suspicion is that they want to raise the factory to build luxury condos for people to move into the Williamsburg area.
So they weren't even losing money
No.
on the factory. They can just make more. I mean, people can go to democracynow.org to see our program we did years ago on the Von Jewels when they became famous for another reason and the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal. One of the phone calls that President Clinton took at the time he was with Lewinsky in the Oval Office was a call from the Von Jewels.
From Alfie Von Jewell, right, who was upset because Al Gore wanted to impose a 1 cent tax on sugar to clean up the Everglades. And he called Clinton to complain. And that was the last that Al Gore ever mentioned of the 1 cent tax. This was during the 1996 presidential race.
So are the workers organizing?
Well, they're doing the best they can. And they've gotten Senator Clinton and Chuck Schumer to try to see what they can do to help the plant stay. But the Von Jewels aren't even interested in meeting with the senators or with the workers to find out what it would take to get them to keep the plant open.
Despite the fact that when they took over, they guaranteed the workers, they told them not to worry, that they would continue
right.
to run the plant.
When they bought the plant 3 years ago, they assured them that they were going to expand it and build it up.
Well, we're going to go south, not as south as Florida, where they are, but to Georgia. President Bush visited the grave of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Atlanta yesterday on the anniversary of his birth. King would have been 75 years old. Access to the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church near the memorial site was limited due to the tight security accompanying the president's visit. Bush was accompanied by King's widow, Coretta Scott King, and sister, Christine King Ferris. Protesters booed loudly at Bush as he laid a wreath on King's grave. Bush's visit was followed by a $2,000 a person fundraiser in Atlanta, in which he raised $2.3 million. We go now to Reverend James Orange, who's chair of the Martin Luther King March Committee. He was at the program yesterday at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. He was also a member of King's staff and was with him when he was assassinated in Memphis. Welcome to Democracy Now, Reverend Orange.
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, Warren.
Can you tell us what happened yesterday?
Well, it was a lot of angry people who were not able to get to the human rights immigration conference that we had set up at Dr. King's our old church where he pastored for so many years. The important thing is that we held our conference. The word had come down early on that the Secret Service wouldn't allow us to do the conference, that we had to end our conference at 2 o'clock p.m. on yesterday. And I just said that that's no way that Martin Luther King stood for human rights throughout the world. We had Maria Elena DeRosa and Patricia Ford and many others on tap to be there. And people wanted to get there to hear them talk about immigrants, immigrant workers, and immigrant rights so that we could build a better relationship in conjunction with the Kenyan nonviolence.
And Reverend Orange, your reaction to this symbolic act of President Bush coming there to Atlanta, given the fact of the kinds of policies that obviously that he has been implementing, which Dr. King most obviously would have been opposed to?
Well, had this been not an election year, he wouldn't have come. He didn't come last year. He didn't come the year he was elected. He didn't come the year after he was elected. But being an election year, it was time for him to show his face in Atlanta and just impose his will on us, doing celebrations that we've been done since 1971. We thought it was a slap in the face.
But ultimately, you were allowed out of the Ebenezer Baptist Church, or at least you weren't locked into it as the Secret Service originally threatened that you'd have to end your program at 2.
How can you get locked in God's house? We want God to be locked in us, not away from us.
Well, Reverend Orange, we want to thank you very much for being with us and let our listeners know that following yesterday's program on the real birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King, the federal holiday Monday, we'll be bringing you Dr. King in his own words. We were just speaking with Reverend James Orange, chair of the Martin Luther King March Committee. As we move now from Georgia to Iowa to talk about the latest news in the elections. One candidate has dropped out at the last minute. Another is surging from third place to catch the leaders. Another closes quickly in from the outside. The race for the 2004 Democratic presidential nomination is in full swing. The outcome of the first round of the battle for the Democratic presidential nomination is more uncertain than ever. New poll figures coming out of Iowa show former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, Senators John Kerry and John Edwards, and Congressman Richard Gephardt in a virtual four-way dead heat 3 days before the Iowa caucus. We go now to John Nichols, who's been spending a lot of time in Iowa, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine and the editor of the editorial page for the Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Good morning, Amy. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, it's good to be with you. Tell us what's happening in Iowa right now.
A lot. It's amazing and probably a little frustrating for most of your listeners because virtually all of American electoral politics is centered in one state, one rather small state at this point. But yesterday, the big news of the day was that Carol Mosley Brown dropped out quite unexpectedly and threw her support to Howard Dean. What's significant about this is not that Carol Mosley Brown was a front runner. In fact, even her own campaign manager, Patricia Ireland, admitted that she wasn't going to get the nomination. But her jumping to Dean at this point provides him with some cover, frankly, against the charges by Al Sharpton that he is not particularly sensitive to minorities. And also a good boost at a time when, frankly, his campaign has lost a good deal of its poll position. The polling that's coming out, which I would warn folks, is not all that reliable. Caucuses are very hard to poll. But the polling that's coming out, particularly from MSNBC and the Zogby Group, they're doing a daily tracking poll, suggests that Dean has lost about a quarter of his support from a week ago. Richard Gephardt has also lost a substantial amount of support. And it appears that support is going to John Kerry and, most surprisingly perhaps, John Edwards, the senator from South Carolina or North Carolina, who's had a tremendous rise in the polls in the last 2 weeks.
John, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll come back to you. John Nichols with The Nation magazine has been covering the Iowa caucus. You are listening to Democracy Now. Stay with us. Coltrane Tippin here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we talk to John Nichols of The Nation, who's been covering the Iowa caucuses. Juan?
John, even though the polls are showing, as you say, and they're not extremely reliable, they're showing the candidates in a dead heat, the reality is that a lot's going to depend on the ability of these organizations to bring voters out. And in that sense, both Dean and Gephardt, who have huge union support, are going to have some kind of advantage on the ground. And that's usually worth several percentage points. What do you see in terms of the kinds of organization that Kerry or Edwards have in Iowa?
Certainly don't have equivalent organizations to what Dean and Gephardt have. Kerry has poured a lot of money into the state, but this is one of the good things about the Iowa caucuses. Money only goes so far in this game. You can buy millions of dollars of TV ads and do all sorts of stuff, but ultimately it is about organization on the ground. There are more than 2,000 caucuses. This is not the equivalent of a primary, one big event that operates at the same time with the same rules. The caucuses occur in people's living rooms and basements and union halls and just all these unexpected spots. And it really involves getting people out of their homes to come and spend 3 hours, usually, with their neighbors to lock in a choice for a particular candidate. What we know is this. There's no question that Gephardt has brought in a tremendous level of labor support. There are expected to be more than 1,000 union staffers and activists from around the country in Iowa on Monday doing this caucus vote pulling. And these aren't just, grassroots union activists. Jimmy Hoffa, Jr., the president of the Teamsters, has been in the state very actively working for Gephardt. So is George Becker, the head of the steelworkers, former head of the steelworkers, and lots of other folks have really come in and put an aggressive push on. On the Dean side, his support certainly he has some union support, as you've written about, Juan, coming out of 1199 and then SEIU and AFSCME. But he also has something that many listeners might recall as an equivalent to sort of the Clean for Gene McCarthy 1968 kind of youth power thing. There are literally hundreds, I would argue even into the thousands of young people from around the country, from as far away as New York and California, who have come to volunteer their time for Dean. They they say, and I think it's probably accurate, that by caucus day on Monday, there will be more than 3,000 dean volunteers who've come in from out of state. When you combine that with dean's in-state organization, and when you remember that Monday's caucuses fall on Martin Luther King Day, a day that public workers, and Dean is endorsed by the strongest public employee unions, AFSCME and SEIU, have that day off. I think it's arguable that Dean's probably going to have the best on-the-ground organization, although Gephardt is certainly very strong.
And we just have a minute, and I don't think we can possibly understand how exactly the caucuses work in that minute. But could you explain, John, can you try to lay out how the vote actually takes place in these living rooms, basements, union halls, cafeterias, wherever?
I'll do my best, Amy. The thing that listeners ought to remember is that even Iowans have a hard time figuring it out. But the key is that Iowa has thousands of precincts. These are the places where the little local jurisdiction in which you vote. Caucuses are organized at the precinct level. And what happens is that at about 7 o'clock on Monday night, people from, you know, a neighborhood or in a small town from that town will gather in a particular spot. There may be 50, 75, 100, or even more of them. In that room, they will divide up into different corners. There'll be a Gephardt corner, a Dean corner, a Kucinich corner, a Sharpton corner. People will go to their corner, and then they'll look at whether they have enough folks, 15% of the overall turnout in the room, to register for delegates for that candidate. If they don't, then they start horse trading. They start uniting with people from another group. Maybe the Kucinich people will join the Sharpton people to try and get to that 15% threshold. Once the votes are registered at that precinct level, then they are all amalgamated into a total. You know, you find out, you know, who got delegates out of every precinct. And on Tuesday morning, those are the numbers that will be announced. So the winner.
But I don't understand. If you had Kucinich and Sharpton folks joining together, what would that count as?
They'd have to join together between one of the candidates.
So Kucinich or Sharpton or someone else?
Or someone else. They could, let's say, Amy, it's, the best way to understand it is if 100 people show up to register out of a precinct, you've got to have 15% of those who show supporting a candidate, right? So if 7 Kucinich people show up and 8 Sharpton people show up, they're going to have to go in a corner together and say, look, we're both really anti-establishment. We both want to get delegates out of this caucus. So what are we going to do? And maybe they would agree, well, there's one more Sharpton person, so we'll unite as the Sharpton vote here, and we'll cast 15, 16 votes for Sharpton. It's a very arcane, very complex procedure. It bodes very well for those who are well-organized because, let's say the dean people have, you know, a really good crowd of folks who show up, and there's only 2 or 3 Kucinich people in a room. The dean people are going to make an appeal to the Kucinich people, say, hey, come on over and join us, because at least you'll be able to cast a vote for somebody who, while not as anti-war as Dennis, is at least titularly anti-war.
Well, on that note, John Nichols, want to thank you for being with us, and we will certainly follow what takes place on Monday and bring folks the results on Tuesday. You are watching and listening to Democracy Now! Juan.
We move on now to the public corruption issue. As Connecticut Republican Governor John Rowland faces possible impeachment, we're going to take a look today at corruption within state governments. Corporate Crime Reporter is releasing a report today titled Public Corruption in the United States. The report ranks the 10 most corrupt states and the 10 least corrupt states in the union. And we're joined by Corporate Crime Reporter editor Russell McIver.
Morning, Juan.
Good morning, Russell. Could you tell me a little bit about what you found? What are the most corrupt states in the union, and how'd you arrive at it?
Well, actually, the AP did a story this morning based on a report, and the title is Image Problem, Louisiana Not Number One in Corruption Anymore. And that's what we found, that, you know, the states that have the reputation of being the most corrupt, New Jersey, Louisiana, Illinois, Rhode Island, that's based on reputation. But we got a hold of a document from the Justice Department that has a statistical breakdown of public corruption convictions by state over the last 10 years. So no one has ever actually tried to rank the states to make a determination which is actually the most corrupt, reputation aside. And what we did was we came up with a corruption rate by looking at the number of convictions over 10 years for each state per 100,000 population. And the most corrupt state in the union, according to our survey, is Mississippi, followed by North Dakota, Louisiana, Alaska, and Illinois. New York comes in number 10, the 10th most corrupt. The cleanest states in the union, the least corrupt, are Nebraska, Oregon, New Hampshire, and Iowa, and Colorado. Those are the least corrupt five states. So the other least corrupt fives from 6 through 10 are Utah, Minnesota, Arizona, Arkansas, and Wisconsin. But two caveats on this. One is these were convictions of public officials, state, federal, local, in the states over 10 years from 93 to 2002, but not including 2003. The other thing is that
it would depend in large measure also on how uncorrupted the prosecutors are who are conducting these cases.
One of the things the people at the Justice Department tell us is that you can have an absolutely corrupt statewide, you know, through and through corrupt. And if there's not a U.S. attorney who wants to prosecute it, it's not going to show up. And, for example, in Hartford, the whole corruption scandal was exposed by Governor Rowland's opponent, Bill Curry, in the last election. But the press didn't pick up on it. And it took a couple young assistant U.S. attorneys after the U.S. attorney in Hartford recused himself to go after the governor. The other thing is, in Connecticut, you have tens of millions of dollars of graft and illegal contracts and so forth that never created an uproar. What created the uproar was the governor had a hot tub and cathedral ceilings put in his cottage in Litchfield, Connecticut, and told everyone that he actually went and bought the hot tub and he paid for it, and he lied to the public. So you can get away with millions of dollars in corruption, but if you say you went and bought the hot tub and put it in and lie about it, then you're going to be impeached.
Any reaction from the state of Mississippi as the most corrupt state in the union?
No, but we're waiting for Haley Barbour and Trent Lott to weigh in. They're not happy. The AP reporter in Mississippi is doing a story. Bill Curry, who lost twice to Rowland after trying to expose this corruption, says now that he thinks Connecticut is the most corrupt state in the union, but our survey shows them coming in at 31. So maybe they're gaining ground. He calls Connecticut Louisiana with foliage, but the people in Louisiana are not at all happy. They admit they have a problem. The last three insurance commissioners in Louisiana have gone to jail. The agricultural commissioner is under indictment. They know they have a reputational problem, but they think they too have foliage, so they're upset with Curry's analysis. But seriously, you know, one of the problems is, why did this happen in Connecticut? Connecticut has a strong economy, but a weak political economy. Politics in Connecticut are not very active. People pay attention to the economy, but not to the politics. And one of the problems is we don't discuss public corruption. We discuss it, you know, when it blows up, but we don't discuss it as a generic problem. And if you type in corruption into the Google News Engine, what comes up are a lot of stories from overseas.
Okay, well, Russell, on that note, we thank you for being with us, and we'll continue to keep tabs.
The report's on www.corporatecrimereporter.com.
And you're holding a news conference today
at
the National Press Club in Washington.
Thanks
for being with us, Russell McIver of the Corporate Crime Reporter. As we turn now to a piece in the Independent newspaper of Britain by Kin Sengupta, and it says the shelling of the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad by an American tank, which killed two journalists and injured two others, was an act of criminal negligence. This according to a report by an international media watchdog. Reporters Sans Frontières, Reporters Without Borders, accused U.S. authorities of concocting lies to hide what had happened on April 8th of last year. And a subsequent official investigation was nothing more than a whitewash. They said the Bush administration must bear some responsibilities for the deaths as U.S. forces entered the Iraqi capital, as well as the cover-up which followed. The U.S. government is accused of ignoring the key to the tragedy. We're joined right now by the U.S. representative of Reporters Without Borders, Tala Dalat-Shahi. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy.
Can you tell us about your report entitled Two Murders and a Lie?
Yes, the report chronicles the situation of journalists prior to the embedding initiative and during the embedding initiative. On the 8th of April, the Palestine Hotel was fired upon, and journalists were stationed at the hotel, primarily foreign journalists. What ended up happening was that there were deaths of two journalists, and that's Tara Prazuk from the Reuters television, as well as Jose Cuso from Spanish Telecinco television. Both were killed. And various speculations in terms of what journalists from the hotel were able to see in terms of the tank firing from them from the Al Jumeirah Bridge. Now, speculations, once we, Reporters Without Borders, went in to investigate the case, came back from the Pentagon, from Brian Whitman, that the situation was not, it was accidental, there was not criminal negligence involved. But since that time, we have received several reports back from foreign correspondents, actually in the hotel, who had said that the U.S. military knew that they had been there for several weeks, stationed at the Palestine Hotel, and that several reports did not get back to the person who actually fired, Sergeant Gibson. So it wasn't a deliberate act, though we do feel that criminal negligence was part and parcel to this particular incident.
Can you tell us about the two men who died, Jose Cuso and the Ukrainian cameraman?
Taras Prozyuk. Yes, both were filming from the 15th floor balcony. They were filming the war as it was going. And what ended up happening was that the U.S. military claimed that they had seen a spotter, an enemy spotter with binoculars from the top of the Palestine Hotel, which, again, was very clear to the high-ranking officials, in particular since the Pentagon initiated the embedding initiative to bring journalists on board. It was very clear there were going to be series and scores of journalists embedded and non-embedded in the region. And the tank was fired, and both the journalists who were stationed at the balcony with very large cameras to view the war. One of them, Taras Prozyuk, received shrapnel in his stomach and died on the way to hospital. And the other, Jose Cuso, received a head wound and a leg wound. His leg was subsequently amputated in the hospital, and he died shortly thereafter.
I remember attending a conference, the annual conference of the American Society of Newspaper Editors last April, where Dick Cheney was Vice President Cheney was a featured speaker, and one of the editors specifically asked him about that situation, and Cheney's response was that it would be ridiculous for anyone to think that the United States would actually target journalists for attack. And so your report concludes that there was no deliberate targeting, but that the failure of the higher levels of the military to communicate to their ground troops who were doing firing, what was that was the Palestine Hotel, that was the negligence involved?
Yes, that's the primary conclusion. But also reports back from Victoria Clark, from the Pentagon spokesman, have been back and forth and a bit confusing. In some cases you see the U.S. military that was interviewed subsequently directly after the incident said that they knew that journalists were there. They knew that there had been several weeks that journalists were stationed there. And then you have the other side of the military saying from the higher ranks that no, journalists, they were not there. They weren't sure whether or not those records were accurate. So the voice of opposition, clearly, in a time of war, people will get killed. And that is the voice of opposition. And journalists who are covering war situations will be in the line of fire. But what I think that the inaccuracy here is that this particular Pentagon initiative was to promote journalists to cover the war. The embedding initiative called upon scores and scores of journalists from all over the world to be in the region. The journalists who had provided the coordinates, for example, to the Pentagon of their offices, Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera, both those offices were subsequently bombed on the 8th of April, killing one of their reporters, as well as scores of journalists coming in from neighboring regions like Iran were not allowed in the region if they were not embedded, in particular Arab-based journalists.
I mean, I guess the real question is, it's one thing to say that the man who opened fire on the Palestine Hotel, was it Sergeant Sean Gibson?
Yes.
The question whether he knew exactly what he was doing. But he was in direct communication with higher-ups, and they knew exactly what the Palestine Hotel was. And you would think they would tell everyone who was in Baghdad, all of the soldiers, exactly what that place was and who it contained.
Exactly, but I think it's really just the storybook analysis of the operation itself, that a lot of information and mismanagement of information was not given to the proper authorities and people in charge, in particular to the sergeant who was operating from the tank. He had no idea, based on his reports and testimonials, that there were any journalists stationed at the Palestine Hotel just across from the bridge.
I remember when Victoria Clark was asked about this. It's hard to remember. She was the Pentagon spokesperson. Now she's being called, I think, CNN consultant, or she's moved on to another consulting group. But saying, well, Baghdad is a dangerous place.
Well, for journalists, it is a dangerous place. But it's become even more dangerous in the situation where journalists are now becoming, juxtaposed to previous years, the direct targets of political opposition groups, and this is worldwide. We're seeing this happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Zimbabwe, and so forth. Journalists are now metaphorically the symbols of opposition.
What about the three Iraqi staff of Reuters that were detained by the U.S. military just in the last week? Reuters contends that they were brutalized, that they were held incommunicado. Have you looked into that at all?
We are closely monitoring the situation. We have representatives in the region that are following up with the situation. Again, we are a press watchdog organization, so we will bark if we find that there was a situation where we have to investigate this criminally. But Amy, I just want to make one additional point. Under the guise of Sir Kenneth Keith, the International Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission, Reporters Without Borders is asking that these cases be filed under the Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission. This commission was established under the Geneva Protocols in 1991. The unfortunate case about the commission is that these cases cannot be investigated until both parties, and that is the transitional authority in Iraq and the U.S., recognize its jurisdiction. And now the U.K. is on board for the commission, but these cases cannot just be investigated by the U.S. if the people who are being accused are the U.S. military.
So you're calling for an international investigation of the killing of the two journalists.
Exactly,
at the Palestine
by an independent
Hotel.
Team, an international team, to look into these cases, almost like the setup of the ICC, to bring forth these cases to the commission to investigate it under its jurisdiction.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very
Tala
much.
Dalat Shahi, U.S. representatives of Reporters Without Borders. Their report is called Two Murders and a Lie. The website, www.rsf.org. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Fazil, 13, is in a men's ward. He was playing in the street with some friends when they found a funny-looking piece of pipe on the ground and started throwing it back and forth. The pipe flared up in Fazil's hands.
To play?
Many women are victims of accidents at home. Zakiya is 20 years old and has 5 children. She's pregnant with her 6th baby. While she was firing up her old kerosene stove to cook a meal, it blazed up and burnt her. Alda, 17, has lost his sight and both his hands. He went behind the lines with his father in search of scrap metal. Anything he could use at home. He picked up a wooden board and set off a mine trap. Kristani, 12, says he found a little blue cylinder in the hills where he was helping his father and his brothers tend their animals. He picked up the cluster bomb and in a matter of seconds lost his eyesight and both his hands.
An excerpt of Desert Rainbow about the Milan-based medical organization Emergency. We're joined right now by its founder, Dr. Gino Strada, who's just returned from Afghanistan and before that, Iraq. The website iraqbodycount.net is estimating that 9,800 Iraqi civilians have died since the U.S. invasion began in March. We'll likely never know what that final death toll is. Dr. Gino Strada, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Tell us about your work.
Well, our work is to provide surgical assistance to the victims of war. I like to say that in every conflict I've been working, and Iraq and Afghanistan are no exception, I mean, over 90% of the victims are civilians. 30% of the victims are children below 14. So we are dealing with a big health problem, public health problem, which is caused by the war.
Tell us what you saw in Iraq. Tell us about the people we just saw in this video.
Well, in Iraq, we have been there since 1995, and we have been through different phases of the conflict, including the civil war. And what you see is always the same story. I mean, you see people who have no medical care, hospitals who are not working anymore, before because of the embargo, after that because of the new outbreak of war. And in the city of Karbala, for instance, where we are building our third hospital, we had dozens and dozens of wounded, particularly children, wounded by cluster bombs, and there was no facility to look after them, so we had to transfer them to our hospitals up in the north of Iraq to be looked after surgically.
And in terms of how the conditions, the medical conditions are since the war versus during the period of the embargo and before President Bush declared war. Has there been a qualitative change in the character of the medical treatment that most Iraqis can receive?
Well, I was in Baghdad in February, and I was discussing with the head of the Baghdad University Medical Center. And at that time, due to this long-standing embargo, they said they had virtually nothing, no disinfectants, no suture materials, even because, you know, suture materials was considered as dual-use material, so import was forbidden. They had virtually no means to provide surgery for the wounded. After March, the situation got even worse. I mean, I remember that not one hospital in Baghdad has been working for over a month, simply because hospitals have been looted. In other cases, there was no fuel to run the generator so that we could run, you know, operating rooms, etc. We had to bring 40,000 liters of fuel from the north of Iraq to activate the generators of Baghdad hospitals.
Can you talk about how Iraq compares to Afghanistan, where you've just returned from?
Well, I think there are...
health system.
In terms of health system, basically what we see in all the so-called third world countries, although Iraq was not a third world country, it has been made a third world country, but what we see is basically the same. The so-called public health system is in fact a private system. Patients have to pay for everything because hospitals don't have medicines, don't have consumable materials. I mean, doctors spend most of their time into their small private practices. And therefore, you have this nonsense where the public health is private, and where you go there as a private organization, you in fact do public health.
Now, In both cases, and certainly in Iraq, we have been focusing on this, the U.S. government has been pouring in billions of dollars. Where is it going?
Well, I'm not in the condition to answer this question. All I can say is that, for instance, in Afghanistan, where several millions of dollars have been poured, basically the living condition and the health condition of the population did not change. What we can see now is that there is a new aristocracy coming up in the capital city, Kabul. To rent a house in Kabul will cost you between $4,000 and $5,000 U.S. dollars a month, which is ridiculous. And that was that money comes from the money of the international aid. In fact, it doesn't go to the people. It doesn't go to improve the living condition of the population.
Now, you're Italian. You're working in two, at least in these two countries, in Afghanistan and Iraq, where certainly the conflicts of the last few years have made many Europeans not welcome, not just Americans. What kind of relations did you have with the Afghani people and medical folks as well as the Iraqis?
Well, in Afghanistan, I think we do not have any security problem. I mean, we have been working in Afghanistan since many years. We were there during the Taliban time. We were in Kabul. I mean, I was in Kabul myself when Kabul was taken over by the Northern Alliance forces. The problem is that, you know, we have been looking after people regarding their political affiliation or ideology or culture or ethnic groups. I mean, and if you do that, people respect you. In Iraq, I would say the situation is a bit different because everybody claims to be in Iraq to do humanitarian work. So the population doesn't understand anymore who is whom. And when, you know, from politicians to army people to health organizations, they all say we are here to do humanitarian work. It's a big mess. And that makes our job much, much more dangerous.
What about landmines?
Well, that is a tragedy. I mean, it's a tragedy that is persisting. Landmines and now even cluster bombs that behave like landmines when they stay unexploded in the ground. We have every day, civilians maimed or killed by these weapons. I think these weapons are a form of terrorism in slow motion. I mean, they have no target. They just hit civilians. I mean, I've done myself surgery of more than 3,000 of my victims, and I did not operate on any soldier.
Explain exactly what happens. What is a cluster bomb, and how does it hurt someone?
Well, a cluster bomb, when does not explode, performs like a landmine. We are talking about small objects, about the size of a pack of cigarettes or slightly bigger than that. Obviously, after a while, they are hidden in the ground. They are covered by sand, by grass. I mean, they are not visible actually, and they move. They move with the water, with flood, etc., etc. So it is a persistent danger for the population, and the population must live in those areas to get the food. So every day you have new victims.
A report out of The Independent, a newspaper in Britain, says that more than 1,000 civilians have been killed or wounded by cluster bombs in Iraq and are continuing to go off.
Yeah, well, it's not difficult to believe. I mean, we have observed a few hundred for sure during period March, April.
What kind of warning is put out to the people now? I mean, the U.S. is in charge. What are people told? What are children told? What exactly do they look like? What color are they on the ground?
Well, you have about 400 models, so you cannot just say there is what this color. I mean, there are some mind awareness programs, but I don't think they are effective. Also, I mean, the people, they do know about the mind danger. The problem is that that's where they live. So, I mean, you cannot avoid the danger.
You have not only worked in Iraq and Afghanistan, you've also worked in Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
Can you describe the situation there?
Well, in Sierra Leone now, I mean, at least there's no war. There's still a big poverty. The social infrastructure, the health infrastructure is very, very weak. But at the moment, there's no fighting, so we are dealing mostly with normal emergencies, not with war surgery. And this is very good. It's a good sign, I mean.
In terms of the doctors who are native to these countries, what kind of a can you talk a little bit about their ability to continue to function and their persistence? Are people just giving up and leaving who are doctors in these countries, or are they managing to continue to move forward and do treatment in the best way they can?
Well, unfortunately, many doctors have left. If you think of Iraq, this has happened over the last 10 years. I mean, even because the public administration has no money to pay the salary or doesn't want to pay salary, so people are forced either to leave or to go into private practice.
Can you talk about why you began emergency, why you spend your life in perhaps the most dangerous places in the world?
Well, just because it's needed. I mean, there are huge needs, and there is very little help. So, I mean, for a surgeon, I think it's a good option to make the best out of your role, of your study, or your university.
And what kind of team do you have with you?
Well, we have surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, physiotherapists, some logisticians. I mean, a normal medical team. We tend to provide high standard level of surgery, so it's not just, you know, field hospitals or emergency surgery, first aid. I mean, we do comprehensive surgery because there's no way we can refer the patients to.
How do you recruit doctors? Is it from all over the world, or is it largely from Italy? Or?
Yeah, from all over the world. At the moment, we have in Kabul also a U.S. Surgeon. We are very happy to have personnel from different countries. And we recruit them purely on the basis of their professional skills.
And where do you get your support?
From Italian citizens, private donations from Italian citizens.
And how are you treated in Iraq, both by Iraqis and by the U.S. occupying force?
Well, by the Iraqis, I think we have good relations with all the Shia authorities that we are working with in the city of Karbala. We have no relations with the occupation forces.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Gino Strada, founder of the Milan-based medical organization Emergency. As we wrap up the program in Bombay, where the World Social Forum have gotten underway, we only have a minute. We're joined on the phone by Vidi Partha Sarathy, who is an independent reporter there. Hello, Vidi. We have 1 minute. Please tell us how this first day of the World Social Forum has gone.
Hi, Amy. It's just, of course, you know, thousands of groups are coming in. There's thousands of groups out here representing such a diverse strata of society and social issues from all over India and all over the world. And there's people just pouring in. Yeah, that's what I can say.
And this is the first time it's in India. For the last few years, it began in Brazil, and that's where it has taken place, the reaction in India?
That's right. This is the first time it's kind of moved from, I think, the West into the East. And, I mean, just that connection is just, one can see the overwhelming effect already on the ground here. There's all kinds of groups. I mean, I traveled from Bangalore to Bombay with 140 children who were bonded laborers or slave laborers who have been freed. And well, they've come to perform. And
Vidi, we're going to have to leave it there, but we will continue to talk to you next week to find out how the World Social Forum goes. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Our website, democracynow.org. Looking forward to seeing people in Waitsfield, Vermont, tonight at 6:30, Eclipse Theater. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.